It's time for another edition of San Luis Valley Voices, a production of SL Voices, your voice in the San Luis Valley. Without further ado, enjoy the program.
Christopher O'Brien first published his investigations into the paranormal as a columnist for the Crestone Eagle, which is sponsoring this podcast. We have with us Kizan Lakai, who founded the Crestone Eagle 31 years ago.
We are very happy to sponsor this podcast, and it is partly because of Christopher O'Brien's column. We started to say at the Eagle, we cover the news of Crestone, the San Luis Valley, the fourth dimension, and beyond. Some do say Crestone is a portal to other dimensions, a high-energy place. The community has at least 25 spiritual centers. Most of the world's religions are represented here. Christianity, of course, several forms of Buddhism, Hindu beliefs, and Japanese Shinto. Teachers and students from all over the world come to Crestone. The Eagle publishes news and information about the spiritual and education centers in the newspaper and on the website. But alternative beliefs are not our only alternatives. Our community is also very much into living off the grid. Many homes are solar and wind powered. The Crestone Eagle sponsors one of the oldest alternative energy fairs in the country. We report on new building concepts, straw bales, dome architecture, earthships, even sandbags.
Kizan, local journalism is in trouble everywhere. Many smaller communities no longer have newspapers or even local digital reporting. How is the Eagle doing?
The Crestone Eagle is doing okay, but it is a struggle for small-town community newspapers to stay viable. The Crestone Eagle is now transitioning from being a business to a not-for-profit public service. The new entity is called Crestone Eagle Community Media, and it has just received qualification for the 501c3 tax exemption. A key reason for this change is financial stability. The Eagle depends on advertising, subscriptions, and newspaper sales for its income. The largest amount of revenue comes from advertising. The Eagle, thankfully, has not experienced anything like the two-thirds loss of advertising revenue affecting print journalism nationwide. But still, we can be hard-pressed to pay our bills, particularly during winter and early spring. So becoming a nonprofit allows grants, donations, and sustaining memberships to keep the newspaper viable. Our goal is $150,000 on our fundraising. The main idea is to buy the Eagle as I near retirement, but the funding also will help the Eagle expand its presence in the new technology, namely a strong website with more immediate reporting, technology that will incidentally engage young readers. We do post a lot of content on CrestoneEagle.com, but we are going to strive to do more. Unfortunately, without nonprofit status and the support of donations and a sustaining membership, the Crestone Eagle may not be able to continue. It would be a huge loss of connectedness and of independent journalism, which is so important these days. However, the nonprofit tax-exempt status for the Crestone Eagle Community Media has given us an opportunity. It is a chance not to just continue, but to have the financial stability and ability to meet an uncertain future for journalism. The Eagle can and will soar into this new world.
Kizan, how can people help contribute?
If you'd like to pledge or make a donation, please contact Dan Frelka, the Crestone Media Secretary Treasurer, at Post Office Box 28 in Crestone 81131, or dfrelka @gmail.com. Or visit the website at thecrestoneeagle.com for more information.
Well, Kizan, we thank you for your time. We certainly thank you for sponsoring this podcast, and we certainly wish the best for the Crestone Eagle in the future. Best of luck to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm really glad that you are having this podcast with Christopher O'Brien. He was a very interesting person. I'm sure this is going to be a great podcast.
Christopher O'Brien spent over a decade in the San Luis Valley learning about and investigating over 1,000 paranormal events, working with law enforcement, former military, ranchers, and an extensive network of skywatchers. He documented what may have been the most intense wave of unexplained activity ever seen in a single region of North America. That region, located in south central Colorado and north central New Mexico, is known as the San Luis Valley. His time, effort, and experiences resulted in a Mysterious Valley book trilogy and includes The Mysterious Valley, Enter the Valley, and Secrets of the Mysterious Valley, one of the largest databases of unusual activity in a single geographic region, is a direct result of his field investigations of UFO reports, unexplained livestock deaths, haunted sites, Native American legends, cryptozoology, and folklore found in the world's largest alpine valley. This database is available for access by all on his website, ourstrangeplanet.com. Christopher O'Brien was kind enough to spend an entire day with SL Voices to tell his stories, as well as stories shared with him by various people in the San Luis Valley. We gladly present this multi-part podcast series to our audience to inform, entertain, and enlighten. Enjoy!
I'm Adam. We're talking with renowned researcher Christopher O'Brien. Christopher, we appreciate you joining us on this multi-part podcast series. And where are you originally from, sir?
Well, I'm a fifth-generation Californian. I was born in the Palm Springs area. I was only there for about a year. My parents moved up to Washington State in the Seattle area, and I grew up in Bellevue, Washington.
Well, give us a little background about you, your history, how you got started. You know, you spent a lot of time here in the San Luis Valley, and I'm sure there's a lot to say just about that in general.
Well, that's true. You know, I haven't been in the Valley for almost 18 years now, but I did spend 14 years there from 1989 to 2002. 10 of those years, I spent as full-time as possible investigating all the wonderful things that go bump in the night around there, which we'll talk about over the course of the series. Basically, when I finished high school, I did very well and kind of aced all my SATs and stuff, and was invited to New York to go to college. I went to Lehman College, part of the City University system, studied broadcast media, and lived in Manhattan for 10 years. Now, I've always had an interest in the paranormal, in haunted sites, UFOs, aberrant social behavior, all kinds of the weirdness, basically. It's always been fascinating to me to see how individuals can experience strange and unusual things, and how groups of people can have similar shared experiences. And I did a bit of study in college around this subject, and also around the subject of societal manipulation with technology by the media, by the government. So I've always been kind of a fringy sort of guy, if you'd like, and have had some fun training myself to always be on the lookout for interesting articles, magazine stories, TV reports, and that sort of thing, and pay special attention when these things happen. So when I came to the San Luis Valley, I did know a little bit about the rather unusual history, especially back in the 60s when there was quite a wave of UFO activity. And then, of course, probably the seminal event in the San Luis Valley in terms of the outside world getting to know the valley. And that was with the Snippy the Horse case, which I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit later. I remember seeing the headlines as a 10-year-old growing up in Bellevue, Washington, and seeing the Enquirer with the headline, "Flying Saucers Killed My Horse." And of course, I immediately bugged my mom for 25 cents to buy the Enquirer because I really wanted to check this out. There's this gruesome picture on the cover. And so I devoured the article before we got home. And so I always kind of had a little tab in my mind about the San Luis Valley. And I figured, you know, someday I'd like to go visit there. And sure enough, I did get a chance to visit there in 89. And I ended up coming back 3 months later and moving there in July of 89. So that's a little bit of a background on me.
When did you first become interested in UFOs and such?
I haven't talked about this experience for a while. For many years, I wouldn't tell anybody outside of my family and a few close friends, but I had an encounter experience when I was 7 years old. I was literally followed around my neighborhood by non-human entities. There were three or four of them, and that forever changed my reality view and was one of the most pivotal events in my life, which kind of explains why I'm interested in these subjects, I think. I was not the only one. There were other kids in neighboring towns that also reported very, very similar beings. They were impossibly skinny. Their legs were about the width of my thumb. Their arms were about the width of my little finger. They were like stick men is the only way I could describe them. And they were carrying these glittering, I called them spears, but they were about 2 foot glittering rods, I guess, for lack of a better description. You know, the image of these creatures is kind of seared into my memory. It's probably the most vivid thing I remember growing up, besides getting my teeth knocked out by a ground ball in Little League, breaking my arm. Usually it's the catastrophic things or the good Christmas presents you get that you remember looking back. this experience when I was 6 and a half, well, almost turning 7, literally changed my life. I knew that there was something going on that we weren't being taught in our schools or in church, or, you know, our parents didn't know. And there was something very high strange that was either watching us or interacting with us. I didn't know. They didn't try to communicate with me. I saw no craft. They seemed like they were like bio-robots is the only way I can describe them. They all moved in perfect unison. They seemed to float just above the ground. They didn't really walk. They moved without moving their legs. It was very frightening. Of course, my parents said, oh, you had a nightmare. You know, you were sleepwalking. And there's no way that that could have been the case. I've never slept walk before or since. I've had many nightmares in my life, but nothing that followed me around the neighborhood. Let's put it that way. So in answer to your question, that I think that would cause any inquisitive person to become a little bit on the motivated side when it comes to these subjects.
Sure, that makes sense. So I understand while you were here, you did an awful lot of research, and you were actually writing for the Crestone Eagle at one point too?
You know, it's an interesting kind of story of how I got involved in all this stuff from an investigator, sort of researcher point of view here. The first weekend of December, we had an incredible UFO event that happened over the town where 200-foot ovals flew down out of the Sangres and out over Spanish Creek. They followed the line of trees out into the valley. I was gone. I was gigging with a band. I was a musician. And so many weekends, I wouldn't be in the area there. I'd be gigging somewhere. And, you know, over the next week or two, I was hearing little rumblings and rumors and kind of whisperings of you wouldn't believe what I saw type thing. And I didn't really pay that much attention to it. After about the third person said it, though, I kind of started kind of keeping my ears peeled to hear more about it. And I happened to give a New Year's Eve party with my partner at the time, Isadora. We had a whole house full of people and it was fun. Everybody's boogieing and dancing, having a great time. At one point towards the middle of the party, I started walking around and, you know, sticking my head in little groups of people talking, and everyone was talking about these UFOs that they saw. And I thought, wait a minute, maybe there's something to this. So I started kind of interviewing everybody and brought them all together and said, do you know, all of you probably saw the same thing. And I'll never forget Charlotte Heyer, who was one of the old timer residents there. She just kind of popped her voice into the mix and said, oh, that was the night there was a cattle mutilation down by San Luis in Costilla County. I literally became an investigator that night. The next day, I called Kizan up at the Eagle and said, man, I think I have a great idea for a story. And she said, well, you know, 500 words, write it up. Let me take a look. Having been editor of my paper in high school and had done some writing, I knew I could do it. So I had about 2 weeks to get my article ready. And within a week, I knew I had uncovered enough material to write a book. I just could not believe all the wealth of documentation, police reports, sheriff's reports. Dr. Lynn Weldon, the head of this sociology department down in Adams State, had tons of information for me. I found the owner of Snippy the Horse, Burl Lewis. I couldn't believe how much information I was able to effortlessly uncover in 2 weeks. My article, instead of being 500 words, was 1,500. And bless her, Kizan ran the whole thing. She wasn't really happy about it, but it was the front page story in the February 1993 edition of The Eagle. And wouldn't you know it, it got picked up by the wire services and it got picked up by the UFO clipping service. And the story, similar to Snippy, went around the world. I started getting requests from France, from China, all over. It just became a groundswell of interest. And so I became a full-time, as full-time as possible, investigator after that first article. And then I continued writing more articles for the paper because there was the activity to justify it.
You said you became an investigator that night and you started collecting information and checking things out. Did you have any particular people who maybe became mentors to you or people that you would go to that you trusted to get good information?
Yeah, well, the first thing I did is I found out that there had been people out in the valley from the field of ufology and from mutology, if you will, the cattle mutilation mystery. And my first call was, and my first interview was with Burl Lewis. Burl and Nellie were the owners of Snippy the Horse. Burl was the handyman down at the Great Sand Dunes Country Club. Hisa Ota, at that point, had just bought it and was turning it into a golf course and country club. And Burl was the groundskeeper guy and handyman. And so I arranged an interview with him. on the phone. I said, Burl, have other people come and talk to you and investigated around? He says, oh, yeah. And he started rattling off some names. And of course, I was jotting them down furiously. David Perkins, Tom Adams, Gary Massey, Linda Moulton Howe, Wendell Stevens, Dr. Leo Sprinkle. And these were all people that eventually ended up becoming very, very helpful to me. Tom Adams sent me several box loads of hard data, you know, newspaper clippings, all sorts of case reports, photographs. And he taught me how to research. David Perkins taught me how to think creatively. And Linda Moulton Howe, bless her, gave me a real crash course in how to investigate high strange events. Gave me suggestions of how to conduct interviews properly. It's different from doing regular journalism. You have to have additional tools in your toolkit to properly investigate some of these reports. And as the years went by and the numbers of people I interviewed went up into the thousands, you really get a sense that not only are you there to gather data, but you're also there. And I think this is really important. I think that the experiencer is more important than what they experience. You're there to ascertain how these events change them in subtle and in, overt ways. I want to know if these things have changed the way they look at religion, how many people they tell, why don't they tell people, and if they do tell people, what's their motivation? It gets into a realm of sociology that I think is an emerging social science, and I'm very, very interested in how these events filter into the culture, how they're manifest in the media, what kind of spin is put on them, what sort of programming are we looking at? And I really do feel that these events are a form of social conditioning and programming that we're seeing slowly unfold.
What kind of changes do you observe in people who have seen these events?
Well, it depends. It depends on the event, obviously, and it depends on the person. But a lot of locals there, this kind of activity, aerial activity especially, is not that uncommon to them and is not necessarily that unusual because people are constantly seeing things around there. That's one thing. In one sense, you get the, oh, yeah, we see those things all the time. No big deal, you know? And then other people who are generally the newcomers are the ones that are most impressed with this type of activity, especially the aerial stuff, which is the most predominant, unusual phenomenon that's there. Of course, the ranchers who experience, you know, losing livestock to mystery mutilators or butchers, if you will, they're worried about the welfare of their families, the safety of their families, and the welfare of their livestock. It's a little bit more serious for them, I think, especially if there's helicopters seen, then they tend to think that they're being victimized by their government. And I would, too, if I had a bunch of cattle and helicopters were seen, zipping around a mutilation site where I'd lost livestock. So you do get some anger issues burbling up, I think, at times in the ranching community. I know lately around there's been quite a number of several hundred livestock have been stolen from the summer pastures over there. And that's been a big issue. I didn't hear about it too much this summer, but the prior three summers, there were quite a number of head of livestock that were that just plain disappeared. And people always ask me, well, why do they leave them there when they mutilate them? And I always, my stock answer is because if they take them, it's grand larceny. A police report gets filed. If they leave them there, then no harm, no foul. The rancher really is stuck and can't do anything. He can't really make a claim on it. He can't file a sheriff's report. So that could be one rationale to leave them behind. I think by and large, people around there are inured to a lot of this activity, and it's not that big of a deal to them.
Christopher, what is it about the San Luis Valley? It's considered what you call a hot spot?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a variety and intensity of unexplained reports that I think is unrivaled elsewhere. It did fall off dramatically in 2001, and we haven't seen the levels of activity that we saw in the 90s, in the 70s, and in the 60s. But there's still quite a bit of activity burbling along. And I've kind of come up with a formula to identify a hotspot region. And if it has the following five elements, then there should be someone local there keeping tabs on what's going on and running around like I did and investigate these claims. If an area has a tradition of sacredness with the indigenous people and has what the indigenous people consider as sacred sites, and if it has unusual geophysical properties, whether it's the proximity of minimum and maximum magnetic field strength in close proximity to one another, as we see in the valley, if there's a tradition of waves of activity, so people will see huge upwellings of activity that are nightly, and then it fades away, if there's a variety of unusual events that are reported, that's the fourth element. And the fifth element is the government and the military being interested in the area, having a presence near the area and trying to expand that presence into the area. And we have that, of course, with the La Vida military operations area that goes down the length of the Sangres, which is the western border of the largest low-level flight training and operations area that the U.S. Air Force has in the United States. And, of course, anyone who lives over in Blanca or Crestone or in Villa Grove is quite aware of the F-16s tearing ass down the range there and kind of sighting cars on the highway. And, you know, it's a little unsettling when you're up five stages of scaffolding, painting a house, and a F-16 goes by level with you. And you can hear the wind ripping off the hull and actually see the pilot's face clearly. And you're standing on a 2x12 and you know what's coming right after that plane, and it almost shakes you off the scaffold. And then he comes around and does it again.
Yeah, we've seen them.
Oh, yeah.
We have seen that. You mentioned that reports of activity dropped off around 2001. Do you believe that that's because activity has dropped off, or have people just become more shy or hesitant to talk about it? What do you attribute that to?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. I think we did see an actual cessation of activity. The levels did drop off. The sheer number of events, I think, decreased. And then I think there's a little bit of a jaded element. People just, you know, realizing that, hey, this stuff goes on here and it's not that big of a deal. And I think with the mutilations, the ranchers just realized that it really wasn't solving anything to report these cases. So, you know, just out of sight, out of mind, drag it to a bone pile or bury it in the back 40 with a backhoe, or, you know, out of sight, out of mind type thing. A couple of cases, the wife would call me and I'd go out there and the animal wouldn't be laying where it was supposed to. And then I couldn't find the rancher, and then come to find out later, as soon as he found out I was coming down, he drug it off and buried it so that it wouldn't become a news item. Of course, a lot of people don't realize that if they ask me to keep the report anonymous, I won't report their names, and I will honor any request for anonymity, which I've never once went back on that promise. So that's one of the reasons why a lot of people, I think, felt comfortable reporting some of these events to me. Number one, I was a local, and number two, they trusted me. To build up trust in a community when you have these types of events involved is not easy. There's a lot of people out there willing to come in and exploit you and then leave with what they came for and then leave you just twisting in the breeze. That's not why I was involved in this. I was involved in this area and still am to help people and to help them come to terms with some of the implications of the activity that they witness. When it has to do with a blood-based phenomenon like the cattle mutilations, that can be a little bit disconcerting. React in a different way than they would if they just saw some, you know, shiny disc fly by or something. That's a very ephemeral thing. It's here one second, gone the next. But if you got your best breeding cow lying out there missing body parts, that brings it home. I really feel for these guys and their families. That's a lost investment. That animal's not going to be able to have calves. You know, they take a hard hit financially when they start losing these animals. So when you have a guy that's lost, for instance, Emilio Lobato down in San Luis up Chama Canyon, he lost 49 head in 2 weeks back in the 70s. It took him decades to make up that loss. And it really impacted him severely. And his neighbors were losing cattle. Like I said, the experiencer, I think, needs the emphasis here in the investigative world. I try to keep in touch with people and check in with them from time to time, see how they're doing. And I think more people should take this approach.
So all this research has actually led you to be able to write three books about it.
Three books about the San Luis Valley, correct. And then one book that is now considered the Bible for the cattle mutilation phenomenon. It's the only real full-length objective look with a case history of the phenomenon. When it was done, it was 900 pages. And my publisher said, well, you got to cut it down some. You know, there was about 300 pages of opinions from different researchers, what they thought was going on. I excised all that information, and I'm going to have a book that analyzes Stalking the Herd, which is the name of the book on the mutilations. It really, no one else has been in a position to have access to the 12 major databases. I collated them all together and came up with a look at humans' relationship with cattle. I think it's a fascinating subject. There's not many books on Amazon that you see 4.5, 4.6 stars. I'm very proud of the book. It's probably the one book that I'll be most remembered for. It's kind of weird that way, but the Ancient Mariner had a dead albatross around his neck. I have a dead, rotting cow. Unfortunately, yeah, I'm the cattle mutilation guy, which I'm, I mean, if the shoe fits, I guess you got to wear it.
Christopher, your website, what kind of information is available and how do people find it?
Well, I have a couple of websites. One is OurStrangePlanet.com. It has articles that I've written, has my database, has a bunch of photographs, has information on the valley. That's Our Strange Planet, O-U-R, Strange Planet. It's a strange planet. It's our strange planet. The other website is UFODAP, UFODAP, which is the site that is for the camera project that I have there in the San Luis Valley. We've already sold a number of systems that are being installed around the country, and there's a lot of very, very interesting information about high-tech data gathering with cameras and magnetometers and scientific equipment that's on there. So that's ufodap.com.
This has been a really interesting trip through your history and how you got started and just what drove your interest and your passion to do this. Before we end this, I'd like to hear just one story, but don't tell us the end. And keep in mind that Podcast 2 is going to be about UFOs, kind of centered around ufology, balls of light, rods, things of that nature, cattle mutilation as well. So give us something to kind of wet our whistle.
My first case was very interesting. I got a handful of photographs from the sheriff there in Swatch County, and they didn't have any files on mute cases. Officially, none had happened, to my knowledge. I was very surprised when I requested, you know, he looked in the basement for stuff. He showed up with 24 photographs. Well, I found the deputy who actually took all those photographs and was able to ID all the cattle. And there was one that came from right down the road in Moffitt. So I went out there to Virginia Sutherland's ranch, and they told me a story of sitting, you know, 13 years before in June 1980. Of course, this was 1993 in January when I went out there. And she said, yeah, back the first week of June in 1980. We're all sitting around dinner, and we heard this helicopter coming from the north, and it flew right over our house. It was right around sunset. We didn't think much of it. And then all of a sudden, we hear it again about 20 minutes later, and it sounds like it's starting up on our property. And it was, they said, about a mile south of the house. And so they ran outside as it flew back over the house and headed back north. It was an ancient, like a museum piece, a UH-47 whirly bird, like you see on the beginning of MASH there. And they said the whole thing was painted this weird kind of yellow color, and it had no identifying marks. They thought, this is weird. The next morning, they wondered what the thing was doing in their pasture. So they went and started checking around, and they found one of their prized seed bulls dead and mutilated right around the area that the yellow helicopter had landed and taken off. They were quite upset about this, and they went around to all the airports and called up all the, you know, rental places and aircraft mechanics, and they tried to find somebody that knew who owned this yellow helicopter. And of course, because the thing was from the early 50s, they said that nobody flies these things anymore. They're antiques. There's no way that you saw what you said you saw. And they said, well, we know what we saw. So I'm typing up my notes the following morning, and I'll give you guys the ending there when we come back on the next show.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it. And we'll take some questions in the next show, too. Christopher, thank you so much for joining us, and look forward to continuing this.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Christopher O'Brien's latest book, Stalking the Herd, is being called one of the most important books ever written, examining our relationship with cattle and how this has manifested into the modern cattle mutilation mystery. Visit his website, OurStrangePlanet.com, for so much more information, as well as purchasing his books and DVDs. Also, visit his website, UFODAP.com. That's UFODAP.com, to learn more about his camera project, helping to capture events all across the nation. SL Voices would like to thank Christopher O'Brien and his podcast sponsors for making this special multi-part series possible.
Christopher O'Brien first published his investigations into the paranormal as a columnist for the Crestone Eagle, which is sponsoring this podcast. We have with us Kizan Lakai, who founded the Crestone Eagle 31 years ago.
We are very happy to sponsor this podcast, and it is partly because of Christopher O'Brien's column. We started to say at the Eagle, We cover the news of Crestone, the San Luis Valley, the fourth dimension, and beyond. Some do say Crestone is a portal to other dimensions, a high-energy place. The community has at least 25 spiritual centers. Most of the world's religions are represented here. Christianity, of course, several forms of Buddhism, Hindu beliefs, and Japanese Shinto. Teachers and students from all over the world come to Crestone. The Eagle publishes news and information about the spiritual and education centers in the newspaper and on the website. But alternative beliefs are not our only alternatives. Our community is also very much into living off the grid. Many homes are solar and wind powered. The Crestone Eagle sponsors one of the oldest alternative energy fairs in the country. We report on new building concepts, straw bales, dome architecture, airships, even sandbags.
Because local journalism is in trouble everywhere. Many smaller communities no longer have newspapers or even local digital reporting. How is the Eagle doing?
The Crestone Eagle is doing okay, but it is a struggle for small town community newspapers to stay viable. The Crestone Eagle is now transitioning from being a business to a not-for-profit public service. The new entity is called Crestone Eagle Community Media, and it has just received qualification for the 501c3 tax exemption. A key reason for this change is financial stability. The Eagle depends on advertising, subscriptions, and newspaper sales for its income. The largest amount of revenue comes from advertising. The Eagle, thankfully, has not experienced anything like the two-thirds loss of advertising revenue affecting print journalism nationwide. But still, we can be hard-pressed to pay our bills, particularly during winter and early spring. So becoming a nonprofit allows grants, donations, and sustaining memberships to keep the newspaper viable. Our goal is $150,000 on our fundraising. The main idea is to buy the Eagle as I near retirement, but the funding also will help the Eagle expand its presence in the new technology, namely a strong website with more immediate reporting, technology that will incidentally engage young readers. We do post a lot of content on CrestoneEagle.com, but we are going to strive to do more. Unfortunately, without nonprofit status and the support of donations and a sustaining membership, the Crestone Eagle may not be able to continue. It would be a huge loss of connectedness and of independent journalism, which is so important these days. However, the nonprofit tax-exempt status for the Crestone Eagle Community Media has given us an opportunity. It is a chance not to just continue, but to have the financial stability and ability to meet an uncertain future for journalism. The Eagle can and will soar into this new world.
Kizan, how can people help contribute?
If you'd like to pledge or make a donation, please contact Dan Frelka, the Crestone Media Secretary Treasurer, at Post Office Box 28 in Crestone 81131, or dfrelka@gmail.com. Or visit the website at thecrestoneeagle.com for more information.
Well, Kizan, we thank you for your time. We certainly thank you for sponsoring this podcast, and we certainly wish the best for the Crestone Eagle in the future. Best of luck to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm really glad that you are having this podcast with Christopher O'Brien. He was a very interesting person. I'm sure this is going to be a great podcast.
We appreciate you telling your friends to listen to the podcast on slvoices.com. And check out our extensive calendar of events. More listings in one location than any other website around. You can help spread the word too by joining our Facebook group, SL Voices, Your Voice in the San Luis Valley, and liking our posts on other social media outlets. Also, check out our Instagram page for behind-the-scenes looks at what we do. And please patronize our local sponsors. Remember to support the businesses here in the Valley. Most are owned and operated by your family, friends, and neighbors. We all love this area, want to see it flourish, and you can help by buying and supporting locally in your own and surrounding communities. Check back for another local podcast soon. Until then, this has been San Luis Valley Voices, a production of SL Voices, your voice in the San Luis Valley.